It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
Good evening, listener. You're listening to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. On tonight's edition, we invite you to leave behind your safe reality and descend with us into the frightening depths of the most terrifying imaginations with two audio adaptations of frightening fiction about deadly destinations and apocalyptic allies. I'm your host, Steve Taylor, and tonight I'll be your guide as we traverse the dimly lit corridors of your darkest dreams. Joining us tonight to help bring to life the frightening fiction of D.B. Anthony and Sarah Jane Huntington are voice talents Kevin Barberi, Olivia Steele, Melissa Medina, and Steve Gray. Now, get your ticket ready. Take your seat in our Theater of the Minds and brace yourself. It's time to turn off the lights and turn on the dark. Our first tale this evening is written by D.B. Anthony and is performed by Kevin Barberi and Olivia Steele. In it, we meet a man caught adrift in the winds of estrangement from his missus. Maybe a stay at a roadside hotel will help things. But then again, maybe not. Now, without further ado, I present to you Soulmates Hotel.
When I left the house I once called home, I knew I was leaving everything I knew behind forever. I put in my letter of resignation with my father-in-law's law firm the day before and hid my bags in my wife's brand-new 2012 Honda Ridgeline, for which I had just spent $2,000 on getting a retractable bed cover. She never used the bed of her glorified SUV, which made it the perfect place to hide things from her. When it was time to leave for my early morning commute to the office, I simply transferred my bags to the trunk and back seat of my Oldsmobile Alero and drove off. By now, she probably realizes I'm not coming back or thinks I have died in some type of car accident between our house and the office. In reality, she is probably hoping that I perished in a car accident so she can claim my life insurance. Even so, my cell phone hasn't rang all night, so I doubt she cares. She's probably lost track of time, lying beside her not-so-secret lover, Jeffrey. I stopped caring before I even found out about him. After all, there have been years of build-up to this moment. Years of unhappiness and abuse. I'm not going to try and put the blame fully on her. Lord knows I wasn't a perfect husband, as much as she was a terrible wife. The problem lay in the fact we never really cared for each other. Our sham of a marriage was arranged by our parents with little care for if we actually liked each other. Marrying me was supposed to keep her from dating guys who were believed to be harmful to her family's image, and my marrying her was supposed to deter me from being a homosexual and also elevate my own father's standing within their social group. I'm not gay. However, my father has always believed me and my interests to be feminine. It was an old-fashioned way of thinking, but our families were old-fashioned. We despised one another from the day we first met. I believed her to be a spoiled brat who got everything she wanted, and she believed me to be a nerdy pushover. Of course, this was why she drove a brand-new, well-maintained Honda, and I was driving an old, beat-to-hell car from a defunct company since 2004. I made plenty of money to afford something newer, However, she quickly seized control of the finances, having my paychecks deposited into a joint account that I could never touch without her present. Besides, I honestly loved the car. It represented the last choice I made for myself and the only freedom and peace that I would get over the years. It had gotten me from A to B for 8 years. I'd bought it 2 years before I was wed to Heather. Before that, my pride and joy was well maintained. It is now sitting about a quarter mile from this hotel, broken down and waiting to be towed. Of course, it would choose to break down in the middle of a thunderstorm. However, I am glad it did, or I might have never met the true love of my life. When I first entered the hotel, I couldn't help but feel like I had stepped into the hotel overlook from the movie The Shining. The floors had similar floral pattern rugs on top of dark mahogany wood. The walls were glistening white, making them look like they were carved from marble. To the left of the lobby was the entrance to the grand hall, where people seemed to be gathering for some kind of party. I paid them no attention and simply walked to the check-in desk. This is where I first met her. As I approached the desk, soaking wet from the rain and out of breath from sprinting the quarter mile from my Oldsmobile to the hotel, I didn't notice her at first. She watched me dig through my pockets searching for my wallet, still sitting in my Oldsmobile.
Rooms are free for party guests,
she said soothingly, drawing my attention. But I'm not a party guest. Despite my reply, she held a key out to me with her right hand while looking into my eyes and smiling. I felt hypnotized by her hazel eyes and was instantly overwhelmed by a feeling I hadn't felt in ages. Happiness. Her hair was a beautiful shade of dark brown that came down to her shoulders. Despite her almost pale white complexion, her skin looked perfectly smooth and glowed with youth and health. This was most likely due to her always working inside the hotel. She was so beautiful that just looking at her seemed to put me in a trance that slowed time.
But indeed, you are a Mr.
Steve. You can call me Steve, I replied in a nervous tone. I looked down at her name tag, which labeled her Megan in indented black letters, and noted her name for later. I wasn't sure at the time what it was about her that made me feel the way I was. I took the key from her and proceeded to the elevator, glancing over my shoulder at her, hoping to catch her watching me walk away. She wasn't, however. She was too busy doing something at the desk. When the doors opened, I was greeted by a couple kissing passionately in the far corner to my right. They were oddly dressed in formal clothes that would have been more appropriate at a ballroom dance in the 1800s. There was something familiar about the girl making out with the man. It was as if I'd seen her before. The top half of her face was covered by a lavishly designed masquerade mask, which was decorated with jewels and a mixture of black and white feathers. I quickly dismissed the familiarity as a coincidence and tried to ignore the sounds of the couple's passion. I looked down at the room key she had handed me. Attached to the key was a brown wooden tag the size of my palm with the room information that read Room 207B on one side, and on the other, it read Floor 2 in gold letters and numbers. When the elevator stopped on the second floor, I exited, wanting to escape the passionate couple. I looked to the floor and ignored the rest of the guests on my walk to my room. They were all couples. Some were even same-sex couples. And having just left my wife, I was understandably not in the mood to be around happy couples. I quickly entered my room and got into a shower to warm myself. It wasn't until I stepped out that I realized all my clothes were in suitcases sitting a quarter mile away in my car. Frustrated, I draped my wet clothes over the shower curtain rod and proceeded to the bedroom with plans to sleep the night away. However, on the bed weren't just the extravagant and soft bed sheets I expected from a fancy hotel. There was also a nice black tuxedo. On the suit was a card with my name next to a couple of familiar purple flowers. When I was younger and into gardening, I probably could have identified them immediately. However, I couldn't remember their name at the time. The larger mystery, however, was how the suit had gotten into my room and onto the bed. I hadn't heard anyone enter the room while I was showering, but there was no possible way it was there before I entered the room, because I didn't give my name until I checked in. I examined the card. It was custom printed on a cream-colored cardstock with golden rectangles going around the edges. My name had been printed in black Gothic font in the middle of the front flap. With a little hesitation, I opened it, revealing a handwritten message.
I hope to see you at the party tonight. Megan.
My heart began to beat rapidly. Though the card and suit were mysterious, the thought of Megan wanting to see me again filled me with overwhelming joy. The thought had occurred to me that all the guests had received similar cards on their beds, most likely with a similar message. But I couldn't help but feel special. Was that what she was busy doing as I walked away? Was she rushing to make me an invite to this party? Did she want me to attend this party? Questions were flooding my mind. The biggest question on my mind was if the possibility of seeing a girl I just met was worth attending a party that I didn't want to attend. I wanted nothing more than to see her again, but I also wanted the day to end. I lay on the bed contemplating whether to attend the party when the soft sheets and comfy mattress lulled me to sleep. I dreamed of Megan. I was playfully chasing her through the halls of the hotel. She wasn't in her work uniform. Instead, she wore a beautiful light blue dress with intricate details I couldn't make out with her running from me. When I finally caught her, we carefully fell to the floor together where I held her on my lap and looked into her beautiful eyes. My reward for catching her was a passionate kiss that I can only describe as feeling like heaven on my lips. It was almost as if I could feel her kissing me, not just in my dream, but in real life. I was woken up only an hour later by knocking on the door of my room, though it had felt as though I had slept longer than that. I assumed it was housekeeping, but I was pleasantly surprised. Still naked from the shower, I opened the door only enough to peek my head around, and behind it was Megan.
Hello, Mr. Steve.
She seemed as nervous as she made me feel.
I was wondering if you were attending the party tonight?
Will you be there? I asked in a tone equally nervous.
Yeah.
She began blushing. Then I'll be there. A smile involuntarily formed. She replied with a beautiful yet exaggerated smile that suggested she was excited before walking away, saying she had to get ready. Being naked, I was partially relieved that she left. I made my way back to the bed where the tuxedo still sat at the foot of the bed. I took it into the bathroom and started preparing for the party. I hated tuxedos. I felt like a stiff penguin wearing it, and the purple flowers on the lapel made it look like I was getting ready for a wedding or a prom date. I tried to casually walk to the elevator without looking too nervous. The hall leading to it was void of other guests, which gave me a feeling of uneasiness, knowing all of them were likely at the party. However, I wasn't sure if I was more anxious about the crowd or over meeting Megan at the party. I hit the button for the elevator, and when the doors opened, I was greeted by the same couple in clothes from the 1800s. They were still making out in the corner of the elevator. I opted to take the stairs rather than listen to the moist sound of their lips against one another's again. I hurried to the grand hall with great anticipation of seeing Megan in something other than the work uniform she had on when I met her at the check-in desk. As I approached the grand hall, it became clear that I was the only single person attending the party. All of the couples were dressed in matching sets of formal clothes from different periods and cultures around the world. Amongst the couples, one of them was always wearing a mask to hide the top half of their faces. The masks also matched the aesthetic of their various outfits. It was usually a woman wearing the mask unless it was a same-sex couple. In those cases, only one woman or one of the men wore the mask. I felt overwhelmingly out of place, being the only single person in a room filled with hundreds of guests. Above us all was a large crystal chandelier that glistened and shined as it reflected the light from down below onto the black ceiling. It created the illusion that stars were above us. While looking around for Megan, I quickly spotted the buffet, which seemed to run the length of the great hall. They were covered in perfectly white tablecloths with copious amounts of dessert foods ranging from simple ice cream to lavishly decorated cakes and everything in between. However, no one was eating them. I then spotted the large bar, which seemed to be stocked with any alcoholic and non-alcoholic beverage I could imagine, including various brands of whiskeys, from cheap brands like Hayes Parker to expensive brands I'd never known existed. Feeling more anxious than ever, I decided to get a drink of liquid courage. I casually walked over to the bar and began looking over the whiskey selection when I heard a gruff male voice next to me.
"Order whatever you want, my friend. Everything is free, even the expensive shit."
I turned to him, expecting an employee, but instead saw a guest. He was a tall, muscular man dressed in the clothes I would expect John Wayne or Walker, Texas Ranger to wear to a fancy party. His white cowboy hat matched the leather-weaved cord of his bolo tie. The tie had an ornament shaped like a revolver's chamber loaded with one .45 caliber bullet. The rest of his outfit was black, as though he were dressed for a funeral instead of a party.
"Is that so? What do you reckon is the most expensive bottle on the shelf?"
I mocked his thick Texas accent as a joke. He chuckled.
"Well, I reckon it'd be this one here."
He pointed to a bottle of Macallan Valerio in front of us.
"I'm more of a simple Beam and Pepsi kind of guy. Specifically, black cherry Jim Beam and vanilla Pepsi." I shrugged.
"Well, it's a good thing that the bar has both,"
Megan replied from behind me. I turned my attention from the assortment of whiskey behind the bar to her. I believed I was still dreaming because she wore the same dress as in my dream when I turned around. It was even more beautiful in person. To me, it was the most gorgeous dress at the party. It was a modern, shoulderless ball gown in my favorite shade of light blue with accents of white flowers at the bottom that went to the circumference of the skirt. From her abdomen to just above her breast, an intricate white design over the light blue fabric reminded me of fancy lace tablecloths. One might have mistaken her for a modern-day Cinderella if her hair was longer and blonde.
"Would you like a drink?"
My voice cracked as though I was a teenage boy going through puberty again. The cowboy tapped my shoulder and mouthed the words, "Good luck," before walking away.
"I'll have a shot of black cherry Jim Beam and vanilla Pepsi as well."
She leaned on the bar beside me. "So, what exactly do you do here?" I asked her casually, trying to break the ice.
I'm the owner. The hotel's been a part of my family for hundreds of years. It's been the tradition for women and sometimes men in my family to run it until we're wed."
"A hotel run by mostly women? Is that how it's become so fancy?" At that moment, I was questioning in my head how I'd never heard about this hotel, if it had been in existence for hundreds of years. However, when she replied with a beautiful laugh that was as pleasant to my ears as a siren song, I quickly dismissed that thought. After a few minutes, a band came onto a stage at the far side of the grand hall that I hadn't noticed before. They began to play a slow song with a mixture of different string instruments, and the couples around us embraced and began to swing back and forth slowly, keeping pace with the song's slow tempo. Megan took my hand and pulled me away from the bar and into her. She put her head on my chest, and we began to sway back and forth, almost in sync with the couple surrounding us. I caught a glimpse of the cowboy dancing with another man dressed as a cowboy, but he was wearing a mask. I wonder if Megan would have been wearing a mask if we were an actual couple at that point. As we continued to slow dance, it felt like time itself had come to a standstill. For a moment, it was just her and me in the grand hall with everyone around us fading to blackness. I could feel my heart racing underneath where her head was placed on my chest. I never want to let that feeling go. After what felt like hours, but in reality, the band started to change tempo in just a few moments. Woodwind instruments began to play as the song sped up. All of the couples started to switch from slow dancing to swing dancing without missing a beat. It was as if they had done this before and expected the song to change. I felt like an idiot, stopping in place the way I did. "I've never learned to swing dance." I was embarrassed.
"Neither have I, but we can copy what everyone else is doing."
She looked around. She took the lead, and we began swinging around and trying our best to copy the moves of the people around us. Swinging around with her like that was the most fun I've had in years. Her Her intoxicating laugh made my heart flutter every time she let it out. Suddenly, she tripped over her own feet and fell into me, giggling and blushing as if she had done it on purpose.
Maybe we should go to the bar and get some drinks.
She took my hand and pulled me along. Normally, I hated being pulled around. My wife had done it to me both literally and figuratively our entire marriage, and before that, my parents. With her, I didn't mind. I loved the feeling of her soft, pillow-like hand in mine. Just feeling it in mine made my heart skip a beat. She ordered us 2 glasses of black cherry Jim Beam and vanilla Pepsi, which was served to us in plain whiskey glasses over metal whiskey stones, just the way I made it at home. Before I knew it, 3 empty glasses were in front of me before she even finished her first. I don't even remember them being served to us. We had sat there talking for hours. I told her my life story while she listened and hung on every word. I even confessed to her about being married, and even spilled my guts about how abusive Heather was. I told her how she gave me an allowance out of my own paychecks and how I could only buy cheap used parts from scrapyards for my car, which was probably the reason it broke down by the hotel. I told her leaving was my only option because I couldn't afford a divorce. She seemed to understand and didn't judge me like I thought she would. Instead, she looked at me with a kind and sympathetic look that solidified my love for her. We had been talking so long that we hadn't noticed that other party guests had left the grand hall.
You want to see what makes me feel better when I'm sad?
She took both my hands. Sure, I replied with a smile on my face and reddened cheeks. She began to pull me along excitedly. She leads me out of the grand hall through the lobby and then past the elevator. Eventually, we ended up at a black door with a sign above it that read, Jardin de la Morte, in raised golden letters. I didn't understand what it meant. However, I did recognize it as French. When she opened the door, the smell of flowers flooded the hotel. She took my hand again and led me into a large enclosed greenhouse. Surrounding us was a beautiful display of hundreds of vibrantly colored flowers and plant life that gave the room an overwhelmingly warm and pleasant atmosphere. I looked at Megan, who had closed her eyes and was simply breathing it all in and smiling. The garden itself couldn't compete with her beauty at that moment. You like the smell of fresh air and flowers?
Like? I don't just like the smell. I love it. This is my favorite place in the hotel.
The room reminded me of my 8th grade gardening club. The smell of fresh air and flowers made me want to open a flower shop when I got older. My plans were killed before I could ever start. My father, who I'm certain is responsible for the term toxic masculinity, said it was gay for a man to want to garden and play with flowers all day. He wanted me to become a lawyer like him. Of course, that is what I became. I wanted to be a florist when I was younger, I said aloud without caring how it would make me sound.
What happened?
I was going to open it with my childhood best friend. We were in a gardening club together. I had joined partially just to spend more time with her, but I enjoyed it. My father disapproved, saying it would have made me look gay. In the crowds he's in, having a son that did anything slightly unmanly made it seem as though they were raising a pussy. I looked away from her towards the ground, feeling ashamed of myself. As a single tear started to roll down my cheek, she put her hand on my face, gently pulling my face back in her direction and wiping the tear away with her thumb.
I don't think you're either of those things. I think you are the most handsome and bravest man I've ever met. You just told a pretty woman without hesitation that you love flowers. Most guys are like your father and would play tough or call them stupid. I think it's wonderful that you appreciate nature's beauty. I think it's beautiful that you're an open book with me. And I appreciate all of it. I appreciate you.
You remind me of her, the girl I was planning on opening the flower shop with. Unfortunately, she passed away from an overdose shortly after I was transferred to a boarding school.
I'm sorry.
She clenched my hand in hers. She reminded me a lot of her, though most of my memories of her had faded. She even looked exactly how I pictured she would when we got older. As time passed, I forgot her name, but always held on to my mental image of her. Her beautiful smile, her laugh, everything about her. I was beginning to wonder if that was why I felt the way I was with Megan when she leaned forward and kissed me. My heart skipped a beat and began to flutter again. I was filled with a feeling of intoxicating euphoria I hadn't felt in years. Her lips felt exactly how they did in my dream, heavenly, like kissing an angel. Suddenly, as if a fog had cleared in my mind, memories of the girl I once knew flooded back. I remembered the time we were tempted to dye light blue roses that instead came out navy blue. Light blue was our favorite color. I remember when we attempted to swing dance in the music room while learning about swing music. I even remember the time we kissed goodbye before I was transferred to boarding school, where I met my wife for the first time. Most importantly, I remembered her name. Megan! I was shocked, yet excited. How is this possible? You were dead. My heart was racing, but for a different reason other than love. I was beginning to feel scared and confused. Part of me wondered if I had passed in my sleep without knowing or gotten hit by a car on my way to the hotel, maybe even struck by lightning. She was dead. I read her obituary in the paper underneath a picture of her from the yearbook. Her suicide even made the local news channel.
I don't know how this is possible, but aren't you happy it is?
Happy? Megan, you were dead. And now you are alive and here before me? I have to be dreaming. You can't be real. I was trying to calm down, but the unrealistic nature of the concept of my once dead middle school crush now being alive and in front of me was overwhelming me.
Steve.
She looked down at the ground sadly. I hated seeing her like that. It made me want to cry. I took a deep breath, forcing myself to recompose. Of course I'm happy you're alive. It's just a hard concept to grasp. I was hoping she'd start smiling again.
No, Steve. I'm not technically alive. None of the guests here are.
She still looked at the ground sadly. What do you mean?
This hotel is special. When someone's soulmate dies before they have a chance to be together, their souls travel here for them to find one day, hopefully.
Tears were dropping on the concrete floor beneath her. What you're saying is you're a spirit?
Yes, we all are.
So why are you crying? We are finally together.
You don't get it, Steve. For us to truly be together, you have to kill yourself. That's why it's called soulmates. In life and death, we are meant to be. We can't be together in life. We can only be together in death.
So the guests have all died? My heart was beating even faster as I tried to understand what she was trying to say, even though deep down I already understood.
To stay together for eternity here, the one that is alive must prove their love by killing themselves. Or...
She began to sob instead of finishing her sentence. Or what?
Or I will have to leave this place forever and we can never be.
I put my hand on her shoulder and contemplated the consequences of what she was asking me to do. Memories of the evening began to flood my mind. Me chasing her in the halls, us talking at the bar, us dancing in the grand hall, her standing in the garden, even the memories from my past with her, from our first meeting in kindergarten to kissing each other goodbye. I never really considered killing myself an option after Megan had done it. I promised myself that I would live on for her. I always assumed she wanted me to live a long and happy life and find love. However, that wasn't the life I was living, and it was her asking me to kill myself. My life was a miserable wreck after I lost her, and I didn't want to lose her again. She was the only happy memories I had. The only person in my life ever to make me feel appreciated and like I mattered. I mattered so much to her that when I was taken away from her, she killed herself. How? She stopped crying and looked up at me with puffy red eyes.
How what?
How do I kill myself? She sniffled and wiped her tears away.
You have to do it like I did it.
You mean I'd have to overdose? The thought of overdosing on pills like Megan was sending chills up my spine.
Stephen, I didn't overdose on pills. I started growing foxgloves in the backyard when you told me your dad planned on sending you to boarding school. When they finally bloomed, I turned them into tea. I drank 2 cups before I started to feel their effects. It was actually a very pleasant tasting tea.
I plucked the flowers off my lapel and finally remembered their name. Foxgloves, a flower known to be highly poisonous to humans if consumed. That's why that cowboy bolo tie was in the shape of a revolver cylinder with one in the chamber. I was piecing it together.
You don't have to do it, Stevie.
She looked into my eyes. Her beautiful hazel eyes again replaced all my doubt and dread with pure happiness. I want to. She plucked a couple more foxgloves from the garden before taking my hand tightly and leading me to my room. Once in my room, I steeped the flowers in hot water. For 10 long minutes, we sat in silence with her holding my hand while we waited to ensure all the flower's poison was infused with the water. She had left the flowers in for 10 minutes before drinking the tea, so that's how long we planned on waiting. She drank 2 cups, and so would I. I was beginning to shake from anxiety visibly, and she squeezed my hand tightly and smiled at me to remind me what I was doing it for. I began to wonder what she was thinking. There was no sadness in her eyes. She seemed to grow more and more excited as the time ticked closer and closer to the 10-minute mark. When the 10 minutes were finally over, she quickly pushed the tea closer to me and gestured for me to drink. I drank both cups quickly without hesitation by opening the back of my throat and downing them in just a couple of gulps. After only a few seconds, the room began to spin. The room began to look dilapidated and grotesque. The carpet on the floor was covered in bloodstains and dust. The paint was chipping and peeling where there weren't holes in the wall, revealing the deteriorating wood beneath. I looked at Megan, whose smile had become twisted and horrifying, revealing sharp teeth. Her beautiful dress was covered in filth and tattered and torn. The image of the couple making out in the elevator suddenly popped into my mind. They weren't making out. She was consuming him. I forced myself to remember walking into the grand hall, which was in a similar state of disrepair, with the chandelier that had hung above having crashed through the floor. The food on the buffet tables had been rotting with mold and mildew, covering them as insects consumed it. Above all, I remember the hotel being empty. I stood up from my chair to flee, but it was too late. I instantly fell to the floor. Megan got up and sat beside me, placing her hand on my back. I felt my heart start to skip a beat and flutter again. I closed my eyes, waiting for death's embrace. When I opened them, the room seemed to have repaired itself. The paint was no longer peeling, no holes in the walls, and the carpet was clean and devoid of bloodstains. I looked at Megan, who now had a light blue mask covering the top half of her face with a golden floral pattern. Her smile had returned to normal. Even with half a mask on her face, she still looked beautiful. She washed away the horrible effects of the flowers with just a calming touch to the shoulder. She was right about the taste being pleasant.
I hope you enjoyed Soulmates Hotel, as written by D.B. Anthony and performed by Kevin Barbieri and Olivia Steele. Olivia Steele is a voice actress who loves the spooky side of things. Her talent varies between gameplay, live stream archives, singing, and other voiceover-related things. Our second tale of the evening is brought to us by Velox Books, is written by Sarah Jane Huntington and performed by Melissa Medina and Steve Gray. In it, we'll meet a couple faced with a marriage that's frankly falling apart. But when they're faced with a life-saving situation, will they be able to come together again? Now, without further ado, I present to you, Survivors.
Lucy pads back and forth across the dirt-covered floor of the cabin in her already worn-out and filthy socks. She stops occasionally, listening to the sound of outside, filtering in through the tiny cracks in the thick wooden walls. Birds, she thinks. As long as I can still hear the birds, I'm safe. Anxiety floods her system. She picks and chews at her already jagged and varnished pink nails, the tired remains of a manicure she'd had especially for the trip. She couldn't have guessed that the pretty cabin she'd chosen online would become her prison. Their prison. A rustic location of blissful and private solitude, the laminated brochure she'd sent off for had promised. Lucy had jumped at the chance, a whole week for her and Adam to reconnect after drifting so disastrously far apart.
I've been seeing someone else,
Adam had told her after she'd found his credit card receipt for a hotel. A cheap dive of a place, perfect for sordid affairs with cliché willing secretaries. Lucy hadn't guessed. She hadn't even suspected. And the betrayal had torn her apart. He always had been expert level when it came to the telling of lies. Lucy believed she was the one person he would always tell the truth to. He had promised such a thing in his wedding vows, after all. Another lie, no doubt. The cabin trip had been an expensive treat to try and save their marriage. A costly adventure she'd hoped would pay off more than the initial grimaces and challenges she'd faced. The first was persuading Adam to take a trip, and then how to pay for it.
Waste of money.
Her cheating husband frowned.
Why do we need to go to the middle of nowhere? We could stay home and argue instead.
But she'd insisted, demanded, eventually begged. Yet the stubbornness Adam despised in her, the trait he always said was a weakness, had ended up saving both their lives. Lucy steps close to the window, holding her breath and peering out through the two thin curtains. There are no movements that she can see. Outside stands a small dirt yard littered with a few old tools. Their old car sits parked up at one side, like an abandoned toy, discarded and useless. A thick line of trees stands guard, an open gap in the middle breaking apart for a dirt path. The path winds through dense, chilly woodland and leads to a large and pretty boating lake. They explored on their first day, walking the path all the way in silence to the shimmering water. Lucy had wanted to jump in, simply so she could feel something other than the deep hurt raging inside her. She hadn't jumped. Adam had stopped her. The loud alerts on his cell phone had started right at that very moment. Lucy closes her eyes and prays. She's never been the praying type, yet over the last few days, she has begged God for help more than she ever has in her entire 34-year life. She imagined the trip might be the end of her marriage, not the end of the world. Abruptly, the birds stop singing and leave the trees in a mass exodus of frantic flapping. Lucy doesn't hesitate. She drops to the floor and quickly scrambles to her prearranged place behind the old soft couch. She tucks her head down as low as she can and fights off the terror. What's happening? Are those things here? Is someone else out there? Don't answer the door no matter what, she tells herself. Those were Adam's words, too. The last ones he spoke before he left a whole day ago. He'd closed the door firmly with an expression of despair written on his face and left, armed with an old crowbar they'd found in his backpack. Gone, to search for food and supplies. Lucy tries to calm her breathing while her heartbeat drums relentlessly in her ears. A scraping sound from outside makes her jolt as sweat drips down her back. She's never felt so afraid in her life. This is it. They're here. I'm gonna die. She squeezes her eyes shut tightly and tries to think of happy memories. One of her riding a bike for the first time in front of her proud parents, their joyful faces and smiles before she veered off and fell. A memory of her wedding day she chooses to push aside and thinks of her giggling happily with her group of friends in a bar. Where are they all now? Are they dead already? Or trapped in hiding too? Lucy can't help herself. Hot tears fall as a loud sob escapes her lips. She reaches up to clamp a hand over her mouth and bites down on her finger painfully. Her stomach plummets as she realizes she's probably given herself away. A single thud sounds on the roof. Icy terror creeps up her spine as she starts to shake. If they find her, she wants her death to be quick. She listens as hard as she can, waiting for more thumps, imagining the sound to be the heavy footsteps of an unimaginable monster. If they see me, I'm dead.
We need to hide, Lucy. They can only see you when you move. The news stations all report the same thing.
His cell phone had died then, minutes after the first alerts. The generator the cabin ran on had died moments later, and they were left completely in the dark.
The whole city looked destroyed, Lucy. I saw footage of these massive things swooping down and snatching people from the ground.
What things? She cried, engulfed by a panic so strong she'd wanted to run outside screaming until the monsters themselves came. Adam had shaken his head and stared solemnly into the distance.
Creatures. The things come from somewhere else.
Where? She pitifully cried. I don't understand. Come from where? Lucy stops listening. She clamps her hand over her ears and gently hums to herself. I'm so tired. I want a hot bath and clean sheets. I want to sleep and forget this ever happened. Tears drip down between her feet, making a puddle of sadness on the wooden floor. I want to rewind time to before. I should have stopped Adam from leaving. What if he never comes back? What if all I can do is wait to die? She's exhausted. Stress, panic, adrenaline, shock. If she could only close her eyes and escape her situation. She wakes. Her neck feels sore and tender. Her eyes widen as she realizes she fell asleep. I'm safe. I'm okay. She croaks to herself. Her legs cramp painfully, but she doesn't dare to move. Not yet. Instead, she listens. No birds, but it's nighttime. Can those things see movement in the dark, too? And what was the thud? Trees? While she slept a dreamless sleep, the cabin turned pitch black, and she blinks rapidly to try to focus her eyes on the darkness. She tilts her head to listen harder. All she can hear is the thrumming silence of the night and her frantic heartbeat. Move, she orders herself. She remembers there's still a bottle of water in the kitchen, and it's at least half full. She crawls slowly over on her hands and knees, aware of her joints popping and crackling. She pauses to wait with each movement, just like Adam showed her, until she reaches the bottle in relief. An almost silent scratch on the barricaded front door makes her spit the water out and cough deeply. She freezes, desperate to cough more, and clutches at her chest. She hears a quiet knocking in a familiar practice pattern.
Lucy.
She barely hears. It's Adam. We made it. She stands up, feeling her joints snap in protest as she races to the door. She drags a small chest of drawers across. The scraping sound reverberates loudly around the cabin as she winces. She flings the door open wide as Adam half falls through, landing on all fours.
Shh,
he whispers, eyes wide and frightened.
Don't move. I think they're out there.
Lucy peers into the darkness and waits. The moon is out and the stars are shining. I think it's okay. The pair crawl across the room to wait in silence in their places behind the couch. Lucy stares at a canvas print that hangs slanted on the wall, a scene of a beautiful, flowery meadow drenched in hot sunlight. She wonders if she'll ever see anything like that again. Why didn't I appreciate it while I could? When Adam decides it's safe, he raises his hand. What happened? This is the first thing Lucy wants to know.
It's hell out there. Dead bodies are lying everywhere on the roads, and those things are eating people. They just snatch people and fly away. Gone.
What do they look like? Lucy whispers in horror.
Awful. Monstrous flying things.
He shakes his head, unwilling to speak further. Tell me, what's our plan? We can't stay here.
No plan, and yes, we can, because we don't have a choice.
But the police, the army, we must be fighting back. Where are the jets or the military? They wouldn't just leave people to die. It can't be worldwide. That's impossible, isn't it?
Maybe somewhere they're fighting, but no one can fight out here.
Adam, if we hadn't come here, we might have been dead already. She tries to hold Adam's hand, but he pulls away sharply as tears slide down her face. She can't imagine what it must have been like for him, having to leave her behind while he risked his life for food. If he thinks it isn't safe to leave, then they have to stay put. Help will come. It has to. Okay, she sighs. Adam shrugs and, in slow, puppet-like movements, fetches his pack. He holds up a few tins of soup and chocolate bars like trophies and manages a brief smile. Lucy nods gratefully as he lays down on the sofa. A sigh of exhaustion escapes his lips as he rolls himself into a tight ball. I'll keep watch, Lucy tells him. You sleep. She settles into a hard chair by the main cabin window and gazes out into the night. Next time, I'll go out for food. I can do it. I'll stay low and careful, and I'll leave when it's dark. She wonders what it might be like to see people snatched clean away and carried off, and what it might feel like to come across dead bodies lying abandoned on the ground. Wait, it can't be both. How can people be snatched and still be laying in the streets? That doesn't make any sense. Lucy holds her hand to her forehead as a swell of panic erupts inside her. Once her thoughts latch on, she can't unravel the idea or stop the flood that inevitably follows. She starts to think of the day she found the credit card receipt, the way her stomach dropped to the floor in shock, the way cold numbness spread through her body until she couldn't stop shaking. She thinks of how she put the pieces together and checked every single date. The nights Adam claimed to be out with his friends from work, he was in a hotel instead. She thinks of the lies he so easily told her, the betrayals, all done without an ounce of guilt on his conscience. When she'd confronted him, he'd been more upset about being caught out and confronted. I don't trust him. I don't even know him anymore. Coming here was a stupid mistake. But if people were snatched away, there wouldn't be bodies on the ground. Think, why would he say that? Lucy thinks of what she's witnessed of the creatures firsthand. She thinks of what she's experienced for herself. Nothing. She only has Adam's words to go on. He told her everything he'd seen on the news, and only he saw and read the alerts. Only he witnessed those creatures. Only he has been outside the cabin since it started. His phone had died before she could see anything for herself. An awful thought begins to spiral out of control as Lucy follows the thread. This can't be right. He wouldn't, would he? What reason would he have? Does he really hate me that much? Does he want to make me go mad? Or kill me from fright? She thinks about all the arguing between them. The fighting first started a few months ago. Adam's words, his anger, and his final brutal decision. The threat that had hung over her since.
I don't want you anymore. I want a divorce.
She begins to pace while the feeling of claustrophobia takes a firm hold of her. She pulls at the neckline of her old jumper, fighting the suffocating feeling. It feels to her as if the The walls are closing in to crush her. He wouldn't. I'm just tired, that's all it is. I'm tired and afraid. I'm not thinking straight. Am I? It's just paranoia, isn't it? No, 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 she silently chants to herself. She tiptoes to the kitchen and rummages around in a drawer. When the alerts first came, Adam had taken her almost dead phone away.
I'll keep hold of it. I don't trust you not to use it. There's only enough power for one call. If that, we might need it.
Lucy had agreed. He was right. If she had it, she would have called her parents the first chance she had and drained the dying battery. But she knows where he put it. She saw. Her hand finds the familiar shape, and she gently brings her phone up close. It feels lighter than it should, and she holds it out into the light the moon casts down. The battery is missing. Lucy silently replaces it. She shuts her eyes tightly, then turns to the sink and vomits. I'm being set up. Gaslighted, that's what it's called. He wants me to go mad. Or he wants me dead. She slides down the cupboard onto the cool floor. A manic laugh escapes her, and she pushes her face down inside her jumper. A blinding thought occurs to her. I should kill him first. She stands back up and rummages once more, searching through the cutlery drawers. Her hand clasps a large steak knife, and she brings it out, holding it close to her chest. Just in case. She is reassured by the weapon. Lucy creeps across the wooden floor and stands over Adam, sleeping. She resists the urge to wake him up and ask him. She wants to challenge him and tell him her suspicions. She wants to see his expression, but she also knows he'll only argue back and deny everything. Besides, he lies so well that his words appear to be the truth. She toys with the idea of holding the knife to his throat and making him tell her. If it's all a lie, the world is fine. There are no monsters, no dead bodies. Adam is the monster, and he can't know that I know. She starts to shake as she feels hot bile rise. She swallows it back down, scorching her throat. Quietly, Lucy sits down and stares blankly out of the window. A calm fury begins to twist her thoughts further. There's nothing bad out there. The bad is only in here. As soon as the first light of day leaks into the sky, Lucy throws open the front door, the door she was never, ever supposed to open. She runs and doesn't look back. She has a plan. She races along the trail that leads to the lake, jumping over branches and gulping deep breaths of fresh air until her lungs burn in protest. She remembers that other cabins are dotted around the shoreline of the lake. She plans on going to each one and knocking until she can find someone to help her. Someone who can call the police and save her. My husband, she practices in her mind. He's trying to make me insane or kill me. Help me! Lucy knows she looks half-crazed. Her clothes are filthy and she smells. Her hair is greasy, her eyes are red, and she's exhausted. She's certain now that the things, the creatures Adam says are real, don't exist at all. She breaks through the tree line and spots the water. A bubble of hope rises in her chest, and she almost laughs. Lucy expects to see boats or people milling around, hikers getting ready to walk, or campers in tents clustered around having breakfast. Those are not the sights she finds. She skids to a halt and freezes. A gasp of shock bursts out of her mouth as her legs give out underneath her. She falls, crashing to her knees in despair. She's unable to comprehend exactly what it is she's looking at, and her mind begins to quickly unravel. Four bright, blood-red eyes, all set in a single line, stare. All four belong to the same creature that stops eating to gaze at her. It tilts its oval head to one side curiously. Two vertical slits open in its face to sniff the air deeply. The creature is the size of a two-story house. It rears up on thick, dry, scaled hind legs as Lucy feels her bladder give out. Its chest is covered in light-colored, blood-soaked fur. A vast mouth opens widely as it bellows louder than a ship's foghorn, revealing layer after layer of yellow teeth as big as elephant tusks and a long, pink, wet, forked tongue. Thick, translucent, vein-threaded wings flap out powerfully behind it as it hisses. She screams in desperation and horror as she sees that the thing it was eating used to be a human. She tries to shuffle backwards, sobbing loudly, but in seconds the creature takes two massive strides toward her. The ground vibrates under its muscular weight.
"I'm sorry, Adam. I'm so sorry."
She doesn't move, but it can still see her. It blinks its many eyes, and she can see herself grotesquely reflected in each one like a circus mirror. With a vicious, deep-throated growl, it lunges and grabs her around her waist with its mouth. It lifts her high into the air above the trees as jagged, sharp teeth rip into her. She hears Adam shout her name over her screams. She hits out at the creature's head with her fists uselessly. She blacks out and falls limp as white-hot agony tears through. Her screaming ends. The creature raises one of its two deadly claw-ended arms and pulls her legs, ripping her in half with a fierce twist and shower of hot blood. It devours and discards, gulping whole chunks, eager for more. It raises its head in triumph and roars an ancient cry into the creature-filled sky. A thousand other hungry roars return its call.
I hope you enjoyed Survivors, as written by Sarah Jane Huntington and performed by Melissa Medina and Steve Gray. Steve Gray is an audio producer / director, narrator, actor, editor, and artist specializing in horror, mystery, thriller, and fantasy fiction and art. He's appeared on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights channel for several titles, including Jeff the Killer, Snow Angels, Sirens, etc., and written original works such as Bestial, The Rails, and The Vampire Testament. As a reminder, voice actress Melissa Medina's work can be found on the official Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, as well as her website, hearmelissa.com. That's HearMelissa.com. Well, friends, our weekly descent into the depths has just about come to a close. But before we go, I'd like to take a moment to thank you for joining us for tonight. I'm your host of the evening, Steve Taylor, and it's been a pleasure. Tune in again next week when we once again turn off the lights and turn on the dark. See you next Monday. Sweet dreams, listener. Sweet dreams.